then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 7th, 2016. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, first off, I want to make a few quick comments on the situation in Harney County, Oregon, with the so-called standoff, which is what I suspect is on everybody's mind. I've already said on my blog and in an email I sent out to the Northwest Revolutionist when this started that until such time as the situation down there is resolved one way or the other, my comments on it are going to be limited strictly to whatever I can say or do that is supportive. One of our many, many bad habits in our wee little movement is that when something of note happens, we immediately leap to our computer keyboards or to the nearest available microphone, and we start chattering like chipmunks, our mouths running at 100 miles an hour, speculating, second-guessing, telling everybody how we would have done it better, trying to stick in our oar and grab some of somebody else's 15 minutes of fame for ourselves, since the media generally denies us our own, trying to get everyone's attention and our tiny little subculture turned on ourselves so as to steal a rival's thunder and score brownie points in a stupid game of gotcha that no one outside maybe 17 people on the internet know about or give a damn about. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you guys get the picture if you've been around long enough. I'm not going to do that with these men in Harney County, Oregon. When the time comes, I'm sure I will have some things to say regarding political and tactical considerations as to how this was done, but a lot is going to depend on how it ends, and as of Wednesday morning, when I'm making this, it could still end very badly if the dictator's thugs get orders to simply go in and slaughter them all. On the other hand, it could go on for a long time. In 1973, the so-called Siege of Wounded Knee went on for 71 days. I rather doubt this will run quite as long as that, since the men down at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge have white skins, and we're going into an election where the Democrats need to be seen as tough on stroppy white boys who don't know their place. But we're just going to have to see. In the meantime, I publish updates more or less every day on the Thought Crime blog and on the Northwest Revolution list, and if any situation arises where I might be helpful, I certainly will do so. But beyond that, I intend to try for an economy of words coming out of my mouth on this topic, especially words that might be picked up on by the media and used against the men down there. You know, I almost said the communist media just now, and it wouldn't be too far off base, but the word communist just sounds quaint and archaic to modern-day American ears, cartoonish almost, like I'm some kind of John Bircher from the 1950s ranting and raving under a picture of Ike Eisenhower. We really, really need some kind of term to describe the American and world Zionist dictatorships and their assets in the media and the intelligentsia and the business world. Cultural Marxist, social justice warriors, progressives, so forth and so on, that just doesn't cut it. Too many syllables, too many buzzwords or terms that need to be properly explained before white people can grasp what is being talked about. And that's one thing you must never do with white people, use strange or foreign terms that you have to stop and explain. Once you stop and try to explain something, you've lost them. Zionist itself is a good word, of course, by no means inaccurate, but not quite sufficiently all-inclusive for my taste, since there's a lot of nuance here, and a lot of these people genuinely have no idea that it is a Zionist agenda they're serving in the long run. Plus, the word itself sounds foreign, and Americans must never be confronted with foreign words or foreign-sounding concepts. You will note that the lefties never, ever refer to themselves as communists or Marxist socialists or Zionists or whatever, as technically truthful as those terms would be. Now, we really need some kind of brief, snappy, big tent and descriptive word for all the many people who are killing us. Something that will stick in the ears of millennial morons and get them to start repeating it like parrots because it sounds cool. Lefty libs is the best I've come up with so far, but it still doesn't ring quite right in my ear. Not quite as short and catchy as required, I think. The new word should preferably be one syllable, but no more than two. White Americans born after about 1990 have trouble with polysyllabic words like, well, polysyllabic. I'm sorry, where was I? What's up next? Oh, yeah. I'm going to owe you Herald fans out there something of an apology, again, because our first RFN for this new year of 2016 is going to be a bit rushed and slapped together, like so many last year, and that is because, wait for it, something came up, which devoured almost all of my available time on a Monday and a Tuesday. Yes, I know, I'm sure you folks are getting really, really tired of hearing that phrase, but I don't know what to tell you. Until such time as this party is able to professionalize and get stable, or as stable as it's possible for any white group to be in this day and age, and until such time as I can acquire a full-time staff to help me, a staff who knows everything I know and who are capable of acting basically as clones of myself, until that time comes, something is always going to be coming up that only I can deal with and which is going to steal my Mondays and Tuesdays and make Radio Free Northwest late or sloppy and slap together. This week I'm having to drop in yet another excerpt from my FAQ podcast back in September of 2010. Now, while I cannot discuss details, I suppose I really should offer you guys at least some general explanation of what the hell I'm talking about here. When I keep telling you that something has come up, what do I mean? Well, a lot of things, but to a large degree, I refer to one recurring problem. The long and the short of it is that for the past several years, I have become increasingly entangled with the eldritch horror and the utter train wreck that is the American healthcare system in the age of Obama. I'm 62 years old, and things are starting to go wrong with my carcass. Like many people my age, I am spending an increasing amount of my time trying to get various kinds of medical care and assistance without generating 4- and 5-figure bills, which I can never repay, and which would render my declining years a nightmare of debt. I am not going to go into how I do this, since there are people listening to this who might use such information in an attempt to do me harm. But suffice it to say, it ain't easy. It requires an increasing amount of my time and an increasingly convoluted application of my time. Because of my gender and the color of my skin, which means that I am not eligible for any subsidies, Obamacare is utterly useless, worse than useless. It's not designed for the purpose of health care, but as a device to destroy the private health insurance industry and a massive bribe to niggers and illegal aliens to vote the Democrats into perpetual power in a one-party state. I was never able to even get into the Washington State website at all, because it was just as incompetently engineered as the primary federal site, but I did finally manage to get an Obamacare price quote from a subsidiary site, that of Kaiser Permanente, a website designed and run by private enterprise, and so it actually worked. I understand that those Obamacare quotes for Washington State and other exchanges were later taken down off the Kaiser Permanente site by order of one of the dictator's servants wearing a black robe, and Kaiser was fined and otherwise punished for publishing them, but the accuracy of the figures have never been denied by the dictatorship. Now, the cheapest Obamacare I could have gotten back in 2012 or 2013 would have cost me $751 per month with a $2,500 deductible. At one stage, I actually considered trying to obtain coverage by listing myself on application forms as black and promising to vote Democrat in elections in exchange for affordable health care, which is the idea behind the whole thing to begin with. But I just decided that there are limits to how far I'm willing to crawl on my belly to those evil bastards. So, you can see that I have been often compelled to take some pretty weird steps in order to get me some free or affordable doctoring when I need it. Now, this has often meant in the past that it will be a Monday or a Tuesday when I should be doing Radio Free Northwest, but I have to be somewhere really far away that requires an all-day expedition to get there and back, or that involves an extensive commitment of time or otherwise takes me away from the golden RFN microphone. Anyway, in many cases, when I tell you that something has come up, that's what I'm talking about. And this week, something came up. I know I've said that I don't want this show to become nothing but a showcase for grumpy old men bitching and moaning about their hemorrhoids. But one possible subject for some MP3 files from listeners might be brief descriptions of your own experiences with Obamacare and with this magnificent healthcare situation that the combination of Democratic statism and Republican corporate greed have given us. Right, let's see what kind of music I can play now about doctors. I'd play the lime and the coconut, but that's too niggerized. So this is Louis Grizzard.
I want to talk to y'all about something serious now. We got to get serious here. Serious, we say in the South. Serious. I can't see y'all because of all them lights, but I know that out here tonight we got a lot of you men. You got them coats and ties on. Hurting your neck right now. Got them big old jobs. Got a lot of stress involved. You eating a lot of eggs, a lot of milk. Getting that cholesterol built up in your heart. And if you ain't had your heart surgery yet, relax because it's coming, Clyde. I guarantee you. I mean, there's country clubs you can't get into today that you don't had your heart surgery. You know what I'm saying? I had heart surgery. I wrote a book about it. Called it, They Tore Out My Heart and Stomped That Sucker Flat. And I tell you what, let me say, I didn't have the classic bypass. What I had was something different. See, in the aortic valve of the heart, where the blood goes out of the heart, there's supposed to be three little leaflets in that valve that open and close real tight. For some reason, I was born with only two of those little leaflets in my heart. It was 1946, right after the Great War. Could have been a shortage on them little boogers, probably. Either that or my daddy didn't get a good toehold, one or the other. Ain't you? Somebody sitting down here just said, damn, brother, I don't believe I'd have told that. You know? But that's what happened to me. It didn't hurt, you know, and it caused me any problems. Didn't hurt anything like that. But I went to see my doctor. I was 35 years old. Now, I'll be honest with you. I know we probably got doctors in the audience, and I'm going to offend you, but I don't like doctors. I really don't. I tell you, well, ain't nothing personal. But we know how much money you make. You drive in big old Mercedes cars. You live on them big old houses out there in West Paces and Blackland and Tuxedo and them kind of places. But you're too cheap to pop for no new magazines in your office, right? You ever notice that? I walk in my doctor's office, picked up Time magazine, Roosevelt's on the cover. Teddy. My doctor's weird anyway. I called my doctor one time on the phone. He said, what's wrong with you? I said, I got a bad case of diarrhea. He put me on hold. But anyway, I'm 35 years old, and I walk in my doctor's office, and he comes out, and he's got two x-rays. He said, here's the x-ray we took of your heart 5 years ago. Here's one we took 5 minutes ago. Notice how much larger your heart is today than it was then. I said, what y'all going to do about that? He said, we're going to send you to Emory Hospital. Man going to take a knife, going to cut you from your neck all the way down to your navel. Another man's going to walk in a room with a Black & Decker power saw. We're sawing right through your sternum. We're going to put a new valve in you and sew you back up and charge you $25,000. I said, do what? That's the problem with doctors. They only give you the big picture. You know what I'm saying? They only give you the big picture. Don't tell you the little. They ain't nothing to heart surgery. You asleep. They cut off your toes. Now you wouldn't care. It's all them things they do to you before and after your heart surgery get you crazy. Doctor I've never seen before in my life came to my room. had the audacity to ask me, was there any history of hemophilia in my family? I said, we had a second cousin one time I wasn't real sure about, you know? His name's Keith. He's a waiter at the... The biggest thing about heart surgery is tubes. Tubes. If you would think about it, ladies and gentlemen, please nobody use your hands to count and embarrass yourself. But if you would think about it, there are seven places in the human body where you can stick a tube without having to make no new hole. You got them all? Yes, ma'am, that's one of them. It certainly is. Now, I am by no means a religious expert, but I believe in my heart that the good Lord in all his infinite wisdom didn't have no intention for nobody to be sticking no tubes in at least two of them holes. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made them so tight. Makes sense to me. The problem with heart surgery, they got seven holes and nine tubes. They got to make two new holes in you. They put one on each side of your navel. That's for your stomach tubes. Don't hurt going in. You're asleep. Coming out is another ball game. A couple of days after my surgery, I was lying there in my bed relaxing with a jar of morphine. Heart surgery will change your attitude about narcotics, I guarantee you. Your whole new perspective. Doctor I never seen before coming to my room, big smile on his face, said, this morning I'm going to take your stomach tubes out. I said, great. Next thing I said is, when I get off this seat, I'm going to knock that smile right off your face.
Down through the years on this show, people have had a tendency to send me stuff, especially audio files, that end up sitting on my hard drive or on an external drive, thumb drive, whatever, and after a while, I simply forget where it came from. Now, this is something I found on one of my external drives during our latest computer convulsion here at the Batcave, and I honestly can't tell you its provenance. It appears to be part of the soundtrack to a film or video made by Dr. Edward R. Fields, one of those many names that all of us should know. It apparently comes from sometime in the 1980s, I would guess. And in this video, Doc gets into some of the great personalities and leaders from our movement's past. And yes, we do have a past. We should. We are, after all, not just the genetic descendants, but the political and cultural descendants of the founding fathers and the original white population of this country. And our way, our point of view, whatever you want to call it, has not just been part and parcel of this country's history. It was the bedrock upon which the old America, the true America, was founded. The lefty libs have got that part right, at least. Now, I need to tell you a few things about this audio. For one thing, it's a bit patchy. Whoever put it together duplicated several sections, and I had to cut out those that were duplicates, and I had to do a lot of audio editing as well. I suspect that whoever made this audio file actually recorded it off a TV set or something of the kind. Secondly, you will hear references in here to something called the NRA. And in this context, Father Coughlin and the others are not referring to the National Rifle Association, but to something called the National Recovery Act, which was introduced by Roosevelt in the 1930s and which marked the first formal intrusion of Marxist socialism into the American legal system and the birth of the nationwide democratic bureaucracy which rules us now. The narration is by Dr. Edward Fields, who is something of a historic institution himself. Since Willis Cardo died, he's the last of the old leaders still standing, unless you want to count David Duke and myself, which is up to you. Doc definitely qualifies as the last of the summer wine that I've mentioned here in the past.
The greatest orators America has ever seen. And we're also going to take a look at several other very famous people and political leaders of the 1930s. Father Charles Coughlin headed the largest right-wing organization of the 1930s with over 1 million members. He was the editor of Social Justice magazine, which had a paid circulation of over 900,000. That's larger than the daily circulation of the New York Times, the Atlanta Constitution, or the Washington Post. While his was only a weekly magazine, the overall circulation, even in this day and age, was only exceeded by such giants as USA Today and the Wall Street Journal. Father Coughlin was on the radio, CBS, from coast to coast, but he had a very humble beginning. In fact, he only had a handful of parishioners in his first church, and they did not even have enough money to meet the bills on their mortgage payments. He was able to get on radio in Detroit, and he had to raise $58 for his first radio broadcast. From that point forward, at age 34, he became an overnight national celebrity. Father Coughlin was concerned with the Depression, which was continuing into the 30s, and actually did not end until the outbreak of World War II. We had over 25% of the American workforce unemployed. At that time, we had no unemployment insurance. We had no Social Security. We had no such thing as a minimum wage. Father Coughlin fought for all of these things, and they eventually came into being, and he had a lot to do with this. During the same period, we had Senator Huey Long, who was on the rise with his Share the Wealth program. We had the Townsend Plan. Dr. Francis Townsend wanted a 2% national sales tax to finance a Social Security program. He was extremely popular and very, very influential. Later, after the assassination of Huey Long, Gerald L.K. Smith, who was a Long associate in Louisiana, took his place and continued the Share the Wealth movement, which later became known as the Committee of 1 Million. Now, we're going to start by studying the style of several of the speakers of this period. We're going to start with Huey Long on running for president in 1936. His organization had become national, and gentlemen such as Dr. Francis E. Townsend of the Townsend Plan and Father Coughlin were all planning on supporting Huey Long for president. Of course, as we all know, in 1935, he was assassinated. We will now study Huey Long's style of speaking, which was a folksy, gentle, and I would say rather comical, down-to-earth speaking. We'll study Huey Long's style in explaining his Share the Wealth program.
Where he stands and not afraid to stand, stand alone.
Crying for wool clothes and for cotton clothes. What did they do? They had Mr. Hoover's plan to plow up every third, every fourth row of cotton, and we laughed him into scorn a year before, and Roosevelt laughed him into scorn because Hoover wanted to plow up every fourth row of cotton. And what did Roosevelt do with your fellow townsmen? After we told you people that Hoover was a numbskull for trying to plow up every fourth row of cotton, why, they put it in to plow up every third row of cotton, 1/12 more than Hoover himself had ever before. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party were just like the old patent medicine drummer that used to come around our country. He had two bottles of medicine. He'd play a banjo and he'd sell two bottles of medicine. One of those bottles of medicine was called Hypopalora. And another one of those bottles of medicine was called Lopapahara. Finally, somebody around there and said, is there any difference in these medicines? Oh, he said, considerable. They're both good, but they're different. He said that Hypopalora was made from the bark off the tree that we take from the top down. And that Lopapahara's made from the bark that we take from the root up. And the only difference that I've found between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership was that one of them was skinning from the ankle up and the other from the ear down when I got to Congress. To have less than a third the average. None to have more than 300 times the average. That means that no family will have less than from $5,000 to $6,000 of the homestead, the things that it goes to make a home, and no family will have less than from $2,000 to $2,500 annual income on top of that. That means that the billionaire and the multimillionaire can have a wealth not to exceed around $5 million and an earning not...
Huey Long launched an attack upon the Roosevelt administration because of the dictatorial bureaus he was establishing, which would control every phase of life throughout America.
Roosevelt administration and the United States Senate that they were making a serious mistake when they began the NRA. They set up and called General Hugh S. Johnson down here to take charge of that particular newly created government. And they began to prescribe a code for the man that was a washing, and a code for the man that was a present, and a code for the man that was a milking, and a code for the man that was making candlesticks, until they finally got 900 codes and rule books, many of which were as thick as a Webster's unabridged dictionary. They provided for inspectors that you had to report to in the morning, and for clerks that you had to report to at noon, and for supervisors that you had to report to at nighttime. They made the whole business world, the whole laboring world, a crazy quilt, a mare's nest. And that confusion has destroyed and put many profitable enterprises further below the mark than they were to start with. And now they have a very poor idea of things. If in order to attack me, they want to use that discredited name of General U.S. Johnson.
The Almighty to send us to a feast. We have knelt on our knees morning and night time. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. We have asked the Almighty to fulfill that prayer of the Scripture. That he would smile on the field. Give us rain in due season. And cause our fields to yield the abundance necessary for life. And that prayer has been answered. There has been yielded too much to eat, too much to wear, everything to live in. The Lord has answered the prayer. He has called the barbecue. Come to my feast. He said to 125 million American people. But Morgan and Rockefeller and Miller and Baruch I walked up and took 85% of the victuals off the table. Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife when they want it. That's what they want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Where's that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need? Leave something else for the American people to consume.
Huey Long's Share the Wealth movement even had its own official song.
Mr. Harry Link to come around to my apartment here in the New Yorker Hotel this morning. And Harry, what I want you to do is to see my composition, Every Man a King.
Fine.
I want you to play it over these people. And if you like it, I want you to put it out.
Every man a king, for you can be a millionaire.
That's fine.
But there's something belonging to others. There's enough for all people to share. When it's sunny June and December too, or in the winter time or spring, there'll be peace without end, every neighbor a friend. With every man a king.
What do you think about that?
I think it's fine. Florida.
Senator, I think it's fine.
With Huey Long dead, Gerald L.K. Smith, Father Coughlin, and Dr. Townsend had to find someone else to run for president against Roosevelt in the 1936 elections. Gerald L.K. Smith was a hell, fire, and brimstone type speaker, as you will now see.
Death of Father Charles E. Coughlin represent the unmistakable edict that is being issued to the corrupt, thieving politicians of America that the baby-havin', stump-grubbin', sod-bustin', go-to-meetin', God-fearin' American people are about to take over the United States government of America.
Clap your hands till I tell you to. I'm running this proposition. I'll tell you when you got something worthwhile. Along comes Honorable William Lemke. He not only makes a speech, but he endorses the old age revolving pension plan and pays tribute to our leader, Dr. Francis E. Townsend.
Father Coughlin's magazine looked something like Life magazine. And here you see a picture of Father Coughlin on the cover of one of the editions of his magazine. He built one of the largest churches in the state of Michigan. And here we see the tower in the front of the church. Every inch of this huge monument to Jesus Christ was designed by Father Coughlin with the aid of architects. There are two crosses on both sides, and then the image of Christ looking down upon the city of Royal Oak, Michigan. On the top floor of this tower was Father Coughlin's radio broadcasting studios. Over here, we see the roof of the church behind the tower, and we see the centerpiece above the church. Father Coughlin was the first in America to build a church in the round. Here we see Father Coughlin saying Mass with the people seated in the round on all sides of the altar. Up here in the balcony, it's a balcony in the round. It was the first church of its type in America, and people said that Coughlin was 40 years ahead of his time. In another case, Father Coughlin had President Franklin D. Roosevelt on the cover of Social Justice. Many people today wonder why. However, at one time, they were very close friends and met often. Father Coughlin helped write some of Roosevelt's speeches because Roosevelt said that he would adopt a number of Coughlin's plans. One of them called for doubling the price of gold. That would double the amount of money in circulation because in those days, money printed by the U.S. Mint was based on the amount of gold and the value of that gold in the treasury at Fort Knox, Kentucky. Roosevelt accepted that plan. Father Coughlin advocated Social Security, a minimum wage, unemployment insurance. Roosevelt promised all of these things to Father Coughlin. And because of that, in 1932, Father Coughlin hit the campaign trail and was the originator of the slogan, "It's either Roosevelt or ruin."
It is almost preposterous on my part to advocate your loyalty to Franklin D. Roosevelt. The events of the past 3 weeks are eloquent in themselves. Our laborers are being restored to remunerative operation. Our factories are open. The prices of our commodities have been raised. Why, may I ask you? Simply because the money changers are being driven from the temple. Simply because the outworn gold standard which held you and myself in bondage for generations has evaporated into the mists of the past. The great advantages obtained through the National Recovery Act are more or less insignificant compared to the greater advantages which the future holds for us once the fulfillment of Franklin Roosevelt's monetary policy will become history. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the day, despite all opposition to the contrary, that you remain steadfast behind the one man who can save this civilization of ours. It is either Roosevelt or ruin. I find it.
To speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly,
and boldly, nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. We must act quickly. And finally, in our progress towards a resumption of work, we require two safeguards against a return of the evils of the old order. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credit and investment. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency.
Father Coughlin's support continually grew. He had over 40 million listeners to his radio broadcast, which could be heard in every state in the Union. Father Coughlin's mail amounted to over 40,000 letters per week. He had to employ a total of 124 office people. And here we show a picture of the ladies working in his office, opening the mail. He also had a private school, besides saying Mass every Sunday, and his radio broadcast, his weekly magazine, and he traveled throughout the nation speaking. Father Coughlin was a great dog lover. He always owned a dog, and he preferred Great Danes. Pal was his favorite dog, and here's a picture of Father Coughlin with Pal. The dog would actually stand beside Father Coughlin at the entrance of the church, and when the parishioners were leaving, they could shake hands not only with Father Coughlin, but also with Pal.
I got a couple of complaints about the music selection last week. Most people liked it, but a few of you seemed to feel that I should have included some skinhead rock or something like that, Ian Stewart, whatever. Okay, fair enough. I didn't have time to get any of that in last week, but this is something called Final War by Raceland.
Fight to the last of fight, to the end. evening, comrades. Today I would like to discuss a Japanese book, and this is, of course, No Surrender by Hiro Onoda. This is a book about defeat being an orphan. Now, Onoda is very competitive throughout his life, and he has very high energy, and he actually does live to be 94 years old. He was drafted into World War II, and he decided to go to officer training, and he was assigned the Nakino Military School. Now, there he learns the art and honor of guerrilla warfare, and he gets inside information on things like the Manhattan Project. Onoda's graduation project was very much like his later assignment in Lubang, Philippines, as it had to do with resisting an occupation force. Before Onoda leaves for his assignment, he tells his mother that he may be reported dead due to the nature of his work. And in fact, he was reported dead in 1959, but resurfaced in 1974. Onoda was assigned to the 14th Area Army, and he meets with strategic and intelligence officers and is ordered to deploy squadrons for guerrilla war in the hope of retaking Lubang. Now, General Yokoyama tells him that he must not surrender and he must stay on the island, even living on coconuts if necessary. He is also ordered not to commit ritual sabaku. Now, in addition, at military school, he's told to expect possibly a 100-year war, so he's of the belief that the war may even outlast his lifetime. Now, majors such as Major Tamaguchi may direct him, but they cannot alter the commands of a higher rank. Onoda is to lead soldiers into guerrilla war, but he cannot decide if they ought to engage. Now, when Onoda gets to Lubang, he finds dispirited soldiers who are looking for any excuse to go back to Japan, even to the degree of deliberately misreading orders. Despite the fact that the author is enthusiastic about the war, he realizes that his assignment to blow up an airfield is likely pointless, as the Allies now have steel plates and can construct landing strips anywhere, anytime. Also, he has difficulty in terms of individuals that he must work with because both the upper and lower ranks are very uninterested in engaging in the guerrilla assignment that Onoda has been given. Also, too, villagers have become afraid to supply rice to Japanese soldiers as they are being more harassed by the Allies who have gained the upper hand. Also, the Japanese soldiers themselves have begun to lose focus, and they start to want unnecessary luxuries such as coffee and sugar. Now, as conditions on the island become more and more untenable, the Japanese intelligence agents are ordered to move into the interior in small groups. Oftentimes, they will have a higher-ranking military agent with a lower-ranking agent, so a corporal and a private might go together, or a private and a lieutenant. In 1945, Onoda sees a leaflet that says the war is over by direct imperial order. Before 1945, there has never been a direct imperial order, and for this reason, Onoda believes that the leaflet is false propaganda, and he becomes very concerned for various comrades who have likely read the leaflet and have been tricked into captivity, and he would like to try to help these comrades. However, he is persuaded to stay in hiding. Now, in September of 1949, Private Akatsu deserts. And fortunately or unfortunately, Onoda has never trusted him, and so kept information from him, such as where the ammunition is stored, so that Akatsu cannot reveal this information to any enemy agents. Now, over the next three decades, Onoda and Kazuka would develop a worldview that suited their preferences. Even after the death of Comrade Shimada in 1954. Now, when Onoda receives a message with a Japanese flag, Onoda hopes that Japanese troops are advancing in Indochina. Now, when a search party arrived in the late 50s, Onoda and Kazuka wait to be contacted by Japanese agents. Now, when Onoda reads about Mao in one of the many Japanese newspapers that are left for him in the hopes that he will gain an acceptance of current conditions, Onoda begins to believe that Mao is cooperating with wealthy Japanese financiers and speculates that several Asian countries as well as Australia and Siberia may have joined the co-prosperity sphere. When Onoda reads about himself in the paper, he assumes that the message is to hold out. Now, in the mid-60s, standard of living improves on the island, and Onoda and Kazuka find synthetic material and tin roofing. Best of all, they liberate a transistor radio in order to listen to shortwave. Now, in the 70s, both Kazuka and Onoda are hopeful because they hear America is doing badly in Vietnam, and they believe that the island may change sides if it has not already done so. Kazuka is killed in action by the Philippine Army while he attempts to light signal fires in order to signal any Japanese ships or submarines that are probably going to be landing on the south shore of this Lubang Island, at least in their estimation. At this point, Onoda still hopes to establish contact with Japanese agents. He desires a phone or at least a machine gun and wonders why he has not been provided with these tools. Now, in early 1974, Onoda meets tourist Suzuki, and Suzuki tells him that the war is in fact over. Onoda says that if the war is really over, he will need to be released from his duties by Major Taniguchi. Now, of course, Onada's orders must really originate from a general, but he doesn't say this just in case Suzuki may be trying to trap him. Now, Onoda decides that he will accept these orders, whatever they are, but he confesses that he is ready to fight for another 20 years. Now, Major Taniguchi arrives with a military detail to protect Onoda, and Onoda, however, hopes that he will be killed in action so that his spirit might dwell in the Yasukuni Jinja. Onoda draws up charts so that the Ministry of Health and Welfare can find his ammunition and extra supplies. And he confesses that he is disappointed that Lubang is not a Japanese bastion and Tai Luk is not a sub-base, and Tai Luk was their port. When he gets back to Japan, he refuses back pay, and he gives any money that is donated to him to the Yasukuni Jinja, as he is very religious. He marries a conservative Japanese woman in 1976, and he ends up moving to Brazil because he feels that Japan has become too corrupt. He decides to raise cattle. Now, he remains concerned about Japanese youth, and he starts a nature school. Now, he also is openly a member of something called the Nippon Kaija, which is a conservative Shinto organization which desires to restore the Japanese military, which was disassembled after the unconditional surrender after the Second World War. So I found this book to be very inspiring. This is about a tireless officer who lives a very austere life. And he has the kind of attitude of tireless self-sacrifice that I wish more white nationalists would adopt. So I hope you enjoyed this summary, and I hope that you will read this book if you haven't already. So have a good evening, and thank you very much for listening, comrades.
Next up, a common topic of conversation of late in various forms, what I refer to as the Tea Party sidetrack, or the neoconservative sidetrack, that of taking an approach to racial and political problems that is all economics and no race. First off, let me explain that I'm talking about Tea Partiers and other people who are basically sincere and who are motivated by genuine anger and fear for the future. I don't mean established neocons or talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. I mean real white people, grassroots conservatives, from whom we will be drawing a very large number of our recruits here on the Northwest Front as soon as we can get them to grow out of their conservatism and become revolutionary in outlook. What are we talking about here? Commander Rockwell once said, "A national socialist is someone who is concerned about his race. A conservative is only concerned about his money." Now that pretty much hits the nail on the head. Not just national socialism, but Christian identity and all kinds of genuinely revolutionary white concepts are concerned with race, with the effect of race on every issue from culture to religion to politics to science, not just economics. Race is the American issue and has been since Columbus first landed on that Caribbean island and chucked his flagpole in the sand on the beach and claimed the New World for the King and Queen of Spain. The basic issue is whose land this is. An American conservative may have the odd social issue on his agenda, like abortion or prayer in the schools or whatever, and most likely he's against gun control. But the fact remains that primarily he simply doesn't want to be taxed in order to support non-white minorities with black and brown skins. He has to work, he never had anything given to him in his life, and he doesn't see why people with black and brown skins should get a free ride on his back. We're often reminded that our ancestors revolted against Britain over a simple tax on tea, and while that's a gross oversimplification of the situation in 1776, it's close enough for our purposes. It's humanly understandable, of course. Nobody likes paying taxes, but to view life through any economics-only perspective is essentially a Jewish construct. Remember what I've said in the past about the essence of the Jewish worldview being pure materialism, not spiritual, not political, not moral, not human. You also need to understand that in the American context, there are several different kinds of conservatives. The two that we need to be concerned with now are what's known as paleoconservatives and neoconservatives. Paleoconservatives are your old red, white, and blue Pat Buchanan and Sam Francis types. They believe in limited government, states' rights, strict construction of the Constitution, unrestricted free enterprise, your basic laissez-faire capitalism. Now, these are the guys who would have been right at home during the presidency of William McKinley back in 1900. The neoconservatives are basically Jews pretending to be conservatives. People like Irving Kristol and the whole goo-boo Jew crew who took over the White House for 8 years when Jug Ears Bush was president. The spiritual founder of neoconservatism, in fact, was a Jewess named Ayn Rand, or Ayn Rand, whose real name was Elisa Rosenbaum. I think most of you listening to this will be sufficiently familiar with what I'm talking about, so I don't have to go off into a long spiel about who's what and why and all the details. You can get all that info from other sources. But the conservatives who concern us here in the Northwest are not these ideological guru types from the think tanks who argue about how many mattoids can dance on the head of the pin. Now, they're part of the establishment. The ones we need to be concerned with are those who are not part of the establishment, the ordinary white people who have emerged from these town hall meetings and tea parties over the past year. They represent something that hasn't been seen in this country for a long time, not really since the Wallace for President campaign of 1968. They're a genuine grassroots movement of white resistance against the tyranny from Washington, D.C., mostly against the forced imposition of socialized medicine in the form of Obamacare, but also because more and more white Americans have come to realize that somehow, they're not sure how, a ghastly mistake was made on November the 4th, 2008, and now there are people ruling them who do not have their best interests at heart and who want to rob them and take their freedom in many ways that they never would have believed possible before. Now, I'll refer to these people as Tea Partiers because it's a convenient handle, although many of them have probably never attended one of these Tea Party meetings or rallies. They're very uneasy and upset about the way that the country and the government in Washington, D.C. are moving, but they are still expressing themselves mostly in economic terms, at least in public. Now, the racial undertone is definitely there, though, because for the first time ever, government oppression now has a black face in the form of Obama. This has brought about a very subtle change in conservatism in that it's no longer quite so forbidden to mention or at least hint at race. The liberal media jump all over anyone who does bring it up, of course, but I don't think that's having the same effect it used to have. It's quite obviously just a ploy to shut people up by designating any criticism of Obongo and the Democrats as racism, and it's so obvious that I think it really just pisses people off and makes them much less susceptible to running and hiding under the bed when someone utters the word racist, and that's a very encouraging development. What's really going to open the can of worms is that the next big item on the Democrat agenda after Obamacare is going to be so-called immigration reform, in other words, amnesty for the 25 to 30 million or so illegal aliens now unlawfully residing in North America, mostly Hispanic mestizos. At that point, when Obama and his Jewish handlers try to legalize all those beaners, I think it's going to be almost impossible to keep race out of the discussion. Now, that amnesty thing is going to come to a head after the elections in November. Everyone seems to agree that the Republicans are going to seize control of the House and maybe the Senate as well, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Obongo call the lame duck Democratic Congress back into session in November and then ram an amnesty bill through. Since the Democratic members of Congress will either be already bounced by the voters and on their way out, or else they won't have to worry about re-election for another 2 years, they'll go ahead and pass the amnesty no matter how much the Republicans and the Tea Party jump and shout and holler. The object of the Democrat game plan will be, of course, to do this in such a way that the newly amnestied beaners can get registered to vote and into the polling booths in 2012. But still in all, the fact is that most of the Tea Party people and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck listeners who comprise this growing grassroots movement of white resistance are in it for economic reasons and because their own economic ox is being gored. Many of them are out of work and more will be as the months and years roll on. Unemployment benefits are running out and many of them are having their homes foreclosed on and there doesn't look to be any real recovery coming in any future that anybody can foresee. Grassroots conservatives know that something is very badly wrong, and they're starting to get a few vague glimpses and flashes of inspiration in their minds as to what. People like Limbaugh and Glenn Beck are giving them a little bit of the story in a very diluted form, but I think these Tea Party types sense that there's a lot more they're not being told. I imagine that the reluctance of the establishment conservative types to come to grips with immigration is a dead giveaway. Bear in mind, organized conservatism serves the Republican Party, and the Republican Party serves capitalism. And it's capitalism that's brought the 30 million illegal aliens here. The main defect of these people's outlook is that they've almost no idea about the Jews or the ramifications of the Jewish question. Most of them either think Israel is biblical prophecy, or else all they know about Jews comes from watching that stupid movie Fiddler on the Roof. That's going to be one of our main roles in the coming years, to somehow bring these people to an awareness of the Jewish aspect of their problems. It's like A.K. Chesterton said back in the day when discussing the same problem, if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. But to what end? The biggest problem of all is that grassroots Tea Party types still believe that the system can be salvaged. They still believe in traditional electoral politics. They still believe that they can vote their way out of their problems, and there are major efforts being made by the powers that be, notably Rush Limbaugh, to absorb these people into the Republican Party and to prevent them from striking out on their own politically. So long as white people are mentally and spiritually trapped in these outdated and archaic forms of political thought, so long as they're unable to think outside the electoral box, so long as they still believe that the solution lies in pulling a lever in a booth for some guy in a suit, then there will never, ever be any real change in the society. There is simply no point in holding elections if there are no candidates who represent the white man's racial interests, and these Tea Party people need to be made to see that.
Hello, boys and girls. This is your old pal, Stinky Whistleteats. This is a song about a whale. No! This is a song about being happy. That's right. It's the happy, happy, joy, joy song.
Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy.
I don't think you're happy enough. That's right. I'll teach you to be happy. I'll teach your grandmother to suck eggs. Now, boys and girls, let's try it again.
Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, happy, happy, joy, joy. Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy.
If and you ain't the granddaddy of all liars, the little critters of nature, they don't know that they're ugly. That's very funny. A fly marrying a bumblebee. I told you I'd shoot, but you didn't believe me. Why didn't you believe me?
Happy, happy, joy, joy. 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 Happy, 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 joy, joy, joy.
Always remember, the primary purpose of democracy is to prevent change, to ensure that actual state power is always held and retained by the same class or group of people, even if different individuals are sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. Democracy is one of the most brilliant and effective forms of mass deception ever devised. The mighty Wizard of Oz with smoke and noise and mirrors and pay no attention to that little hook-nosed man behind the curtain. As long as conservatives and Tea Partiers and Ron Paulites and whoever refuse to acknowledge the issue of race and remain ignorant of the Jewish question, they will never be able to effect any kind of change, and things will keep on getting worse and worse and worse until the white race becomes extinct about a century from now. Next question, why do I use forbidden words on here, specifically nigger and kike and faggot and so on, and don't I think I would attract a better class of people if I used all the usual polite circumlocutions? Okay, I went over this one just a couple of weeks ago, but this is a very commonly asked question, and the answer is important in a spiritual sense, so I'm going to have another go at it. And I apologize to those of you to whom this will be old hat. Now, before I get into it, I want to take time out and urge all of you that if any of you out there have not read George Orwell's historic novel 1984, I urge you to obtain a copy and do so immediately. I myself try to reread this book at least once a year. I've probably read it more often than Mein Kampf and White Power combined. Even though it was written in 1948, and even though it describes an older, Stalinist form of tyranny, Orwell's novel explains almost everything you always wanted to know about the world we live in today, but didn't know who to ask. When you get your copy, I recommend that you start with the appendix at the end of the book, which discusses something called Newspeak. This is, in my opinion, probably the most brilliant and insightful part of the novel. It's an essay on the use and perversion of language in order to control thought, and it's even more applicable today than it was 60 years ago when it was first written. Now, this, in essence, is the secret of the Jewish control of our lives. They are able to dictate what we think and control what we believe because they select the parameters of discussion and thought, and they decide what ideas and what thoughts are acceptable and what isn't. The people who rule us don't give a rat's ass about the poor offended feelings of blacks or spics or even Jews and bugger boys. That's not the reason these words are forbidden. What the ruling class wants to do is to control our very thoughts by making us afraid to speak certain words out loud for fear of economic retaliation and, in Europe, legal punishment, or in this country, fear of psychotic violence from non-whites. Our masters want us so afraid to speak these words that we censor our own selves so effectively that we don't even think these words or think about the concepts and ideas of racial difference and white superiority that those words convey. Our masters don't only want us afraid to say nigger, they don't want us even to think nigger, or to be able to think it. The wealthy liberals and Jews who rule us don't want white people to think any thought that contradicts what we're taught in our politically correct classrooms or by our left-wing Zionist state media. They don't want white people even to have in their minds words that can even so much as formulate forbidden thoughts, never mind express them. The long-term goal, as stated in Orwell's 1984, is to make so-called thought crime impossible because we will lack even the language necessary to formulate forbidden thoughts in our minds. Now, this is the reason that I use words like nigger and kike and beaner and faggot, because our slave masters don't want me to. And whatever the regime wants white people not to do, we're under a moral obligation to do as often as possible. White people have to break out of this mental straitjacket and recover our freedom of speech and thought, and that first and foremost represents the freedom to say nigger and kike and faggot. Because, you see, that's exactly what these people are. There is no such thing as an African-American. There is no such thing as a black person. The term person implies an equality with white people which does not, in fact, exist in the real world. They are not people, at least not in the same sense that we are. They're niggers. There is no such thing as a gay person. There is nothing gay about filthy and unsanitary perversions that spread loathsome diseases. The word homosexual is simply a descriptive term for certain unnatural sexual acts. It does not describe the people who commit those acts. Those people are faggots, queers, bugger boys, dykes. To refer to these people without any negative connotation is to imply that they and their perversions are somehow acceptable in civilized society, and they're not. White people and the defenders of Western civilization have to stop letting the enemy define the parameters of discussion and determine what is and is not acceptable by way of thought and language. We need to force that power out of their hands and back into ours, preferably with a good sharp crack in the skull from a baseball bat. Now that's another thing we need to be free to at least think. We need to be able to encompass in our imaginations the concept of liberals and Jews being forced to do things that we want them to do. We need to envision them being compelled to change their behavior. We need to see them in our mind's eye being punished for what they have done in the past. And I don't mean by being scolded on blogs. The thought is father to the deed, as liberals know full well. If we are free to think disrespectfully of minorities and perverts and the system itself, then it's only a matter of time before we start thinking about doing something about them and bringing about genuine change and breaking out of the forced respect and subservience which democracy imposes on us. And that's what they're really terrified of. There is nothing that frightens a Jew or a liberal more than a white man whose mind is not under control. Okay, next question, although it really isn't a question, it's a naysay. I get this one a lot.
I ain't gonna move, Harold. Yeah.
Or more often, I get, Harold, I just can't pull up stakes and move to the Northwest. It's too hard. The hill is too steep, and I'm too poor, and oh, isn't it all so horrible? Yada, yada, yada. Well, the short answer is, fine. Stay where you are, right there, while your surroundings get blacker and browner and crappier, until you're the only white person left in your neighborhood, and until you're in your 60s and 70s and you've got iron bars on all your windows and you don't dare leave the house for fear of being assaulted, robbed, or murdered by niggers or beaners. And then you can cower in your living room all day staring at the TV, wishing to hell you could turn the clock back to 2010 and come home to the Northwest like Harold Covington begged you to do back then. Look, people, the coming decades are going to be full of problems and chaos everywhere, and one way or the other there will be a lot of migration going on the part of everybody, a lot of it unwilling and unwanted. Northwest migration is a good and sensible answer to a lot of the problems you have in your personal and family life, problems that you will eventually have to deal with one way or the other. And while it's not easy, it's always easier to consciously choose to step away before you are forced to leave. Much easier than it is to abandon your home in pain and storm and disaster when something happens that makes it simply impossible for you to remain where you are any longer. All this talk about standing and fighting is bullshit. It's just another excuse not to come home to avoid risk and inconvenience. No one is standing and fighting anywhere. For white people, getting out of Dodge is the way to go, to the Northwest, where we can build communities and someday really stand and fight with our own people around us. People, things are going to get bad, bad, bad. You really should consider leaving where you are and doing it sooner rather than later, because you have little or no hope of successfully remaining in place in the storm that's coming. If you wait to make the move until things get much worse, how likely is it that you'll be able to sell your house as the area you live in becomes unfit for human habitation? You may be worried that you can't get your equity out now. Well, what about another 5 or 10 years? Do you really want to gamble on the system being able to right itself one last time? I mean, you do realize, don't you, that the great housing boom of the early 2000s is gone forever and it's not coming back? You may be one of those stubborn people who just says, "This is my home and I'm staying here." But I got a hot flash for you. Your right to live where and how you want is not inviolable. When things get worse and worse, no one is going to care about you or what you want or your so-called rights. In case you hadn't noticed, white people don't run this country anymore except for the very super rich ones at the top. And when something bad happens and you call the police, there's a good chance nowadays that the officer who responds is going to have a black or brown face. Now, that means that he hates you for the color of your skin. What kind of help or support for your so-called rights do you think you're going to get there? Guys, the clock is ticking. You damn well better start making serious plans to come home now, while you can still bring with you some of your assets and some of your old life. Because when the shit hits the fan, if you can make it out of Pittsburgh or Devil's Johnny House, Tennessee, or Milwaukee, you're going to find yourself and your family fleeing Northwest with nothing. Well, for now, our time's up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaman. Freedom.